And it is 23 and a half after the hour. It's a winsome Wednesday morning. And back with us after a week away. We missed Robbie last week, but Pastor Robbie Pruitt back with us here. Anglican pastor from the wilds of Virginia. Except, are there wilds in Virginia? I think of it as a heavily populated area. I know Washington and Fredericksburg. And how about Leesburg and Ashburn up in that area? What's it like?
Well, I think the whole place is a little bit wild, but that's just me.
I mean, naturally wild, you know? Forests ancient mountains and beautiful scenery in Virginia.
Yeah, we can see the Shenandoah Mountains not too far from our home. We see the mountains in the distance, and as I like to say, it gives us hope, you know?
Are you close to the Appalachian Trail? Can you hop on the Appalachian Trail, head north or south?
Absolutely. Sky Meadows is probably the closest place where the AT comes through, and that's, you know.
Oh, the AT. Now I know you're that familiar with it. You can call it by its initials. I never heard that.
Right. Okay. I've hiked the Appalachian Trail, not the whole thing, but segments of it along the way, various circuit hikes that I've done. My wife and I were avid backpackers before having children, and we'll still go up to Skyland and hike, and as well as Sky Meadows. And the AT goes through Skyland and Sky Meadows. Skyland is in Shenandoah National Park, and then Sky Meadows is a little closer to us, goes across 66 and just west of us a little bit here.
You've also got a lot of wonderful Civil War sites, battle sites there. Are you a Civil War buff at all? It's easy
I'm
to be.
Not, but I have visited. Bull Run has wonderful bluebells this time of year. We went, I guess, about 3 or 4 weeks ago and hiked the Bluebell Trail there at Bull Run in Manassas. Mm-hmm. And, lots of Civil War. We were just in Harper's Ferry, where John Brown had his hold out, and we did some riding out there on the C&O Canal Road. Mm-hmm. It's beautiful. I mean, it really is a beautiful. Yeah. You asked the question, is there wild? Yes, there are, and it's beautiful. I mean, we love getting out on our bikes on the C&O Canal Path and the WNOD Bandon Railroad Trail, and it's just beautiful around Leesburg and Purcellville. We've only been here 13 months, but we absolutely love it.
Well, you're in a blessed area, a threatened area, because you got all those people and all that traffic and all those lawyers, for Pete's sakes.
That's right.
You need more pastors and fewer lawyers, I think.
Well, indeed. Well, I missed you and David last week. We were spending some time with our family, but I could tell Wednesday was not the same for me either. So I missed talking biblical context with you.
Well, we're getting used to you. We're making the adjustment here. You know, we had Doug Greenwald of Preserving Bible Time so many times over the years, virtually every Wednesday. And now that he's gone, there's been kind of a void. And you're filling it so beautifully. And the fact that you know Doug and you're now a member of the board of Preserving Bible Times, you fit in so well. And we can continue, really, his legacy in focusing on biblical context. One of the aspects of context comes to us from, I want to call it the science of archaeology, but archaeology is as much art as it is science, it seems to me. Science became allied with archaeology in the late 19th century. And one of the first things that archaeologists wanted to do was to verify biblical places, cities and stories and peoples and kings and the like. And over the intervening 150 years, 170 years now, they've done that magnificently. And you mentioned to us this morning a relatively recent discovery, Bethsaida. Tell us about that city. Now, have they really found it, do you suppose?
Well, there are a few. Scholars are divided on which of the sites is Bethsaida. One of the sites is about a mile and a half north of the Sea of Galilee, and that's a long way away from the Sea of Galilee to be a seaside fishing village.
How do we know it was a fishing village, though? Does the Bible say it was a fishing village?
Well, again, I believe that's an assumption that we're making, and we're making that assumption because Philip is from there, as well as Andrew.
Peter and Andrew.
And possibly Peter. And these are fishermen, and they would have taken on their family's business of fishermen, of being fishermen, so of fishing. So if they are indeed fishermen, then we would assume they would be from a seaside town, but there's no reason why they can't travel half a mile, a mile down the hill and do their fishing.
There's an assumption. We seem to pair the word village with fishing almost like automatically. It's a reflex. But there can be big cities. There are big cities now whose major industry is fishing. All along the Mediterranean, there are such places. And who's to say that wasn't the case at Galilee? Because this story from biblical archaeology makes it plain that the Romans had built up that area quite a bit in the first three centuries of the CE or AD, Common Era, which would include Bible times. So perhaps Bethsaida was actually a pretty sizable city. And historically, we know it was.
Well, you mentioned the art and the science of biblical archaeology, and the science piece is it's amazing the technology that's surrounding archaeology these days, that there is ground-penetrating radar where you can do an archaeological discovery without digging the first hole. You've got mm-hmm. this radar that can actually look through the layers and tell the archaeologist what is there before they even uncover it.
I think you can select the depth, and you can actually map what's underground. And we have learned, archaeology has made it obvious, that many of the sites that we want to study from the Bible are now fairly deep underground. It's hard to understand that, how a couple thousand years could build up dust and residue and whatever falls from the sky and actually bury a city. To think that the cities of modern America may well be underground in 2,000 mm-hmm. years, assuming they're still here at all, it's tough to deal with that. It's hard to understand that.
Right. And what they say about real estate is, my mom used to sell real estate, and it's location, location, location.
Mm-hmm.
So once you've got a good location, when a city is destroyed or becomes old and worn, and you tear it down, you build it back in the same place, or you use some of the old remains to build a new place if it's destroyed during a battle or a war. And certainly over the years, you build a mound higher and higher and higher, and it has these layers. And so this is what archaeologists call a tell. So this was one of the discoveries when one of the archaeologists was orienting himself to the highest tell on the northern shore of the Sea of Galilee, which is now a suspected spot that could be the biblical Bethsaida. But you can't talk about Bethsaida without also talking about Chorazin and Capernaum. They call this the triangle, the evangelical triangle. And this is where Jesus spends 80 to 85% of his ministry, in this triangle in the Galilee region. Now, Jesus makes his hometown in Capernaum, but he's, of course, from Nazareth. He's born in Bethlehem. But Nazareth is in the Galilee region, and so is Chorazin, Bethsaida, and Capernaum. So Jesus has a lot to say to these cities and about these cities because he spent a lot of time there.
There are two sites, one now a mile and a half from the current shore of Galilee, that is suspected of being Bethsaida. I'm remembering other stories of research recently in Israel that goes back to the 1990s, I believe, when the water level of Galilee was exceedingly low. And they were discovering sites of cities around the perimeter that had been bustling fishing or trading ports back in Bible times that they didn't know about because they'd been underwater all that time, including some classic ships, the very kind that Jesus and the disciples may have sailed to the other side in. You know, a fishing ship that is and I've seen the model. They've restored one, and it seems to me it was like 20 feet long, 20, 25 feet long, maybe longer. But, you know, 7, 8, 9 people could work in it and sail comfortably. So we're learning a lot from archaeology still. And isn't it possible that the water level of Galilee was higher back then? I assume they could tell that by whatever is underground.
Absolutely. And it actually debunks this idea that this Bethsaida location was seaside. I mean, they've mapped it out, and you can see the water lines. There's an article on biblical archaeology review. And you can see that at biblicalarchaeology.org. Just search Bethsaida. One of the diagrams that they've restructured the water line has a like an inlet that goes far north where the Jordan River is flowing into the Sea of Galilee, and they have it swollen. But what you just mentioned, and Doug used to talk a lot about the 15 ports that are around the Sea of Galilee, and we know there were 15 ports because, indeed, when the water level has receded because of irrigation in the Galilee region, modern irrigation has actually drained and lowered the sea level of both the Sea of Galilee and the Dead Sea. And because of the lowered sea level, we have found what you just mentioned, a first century fishing boat, which dates back to the time of Jesus. Who knows if Jesus even used that boat at some point, which is why they've named it the Jesus boat. They've got it preserved, and you can see it. It's in a museum, I believe it's near Magdala, on the western shore, the northwestern shore. And I visited the Jesus boat. I've seen it. I've taken a fishing boat across the Sea of Galilee, and I've witnessed firsthand the lower sea level, and you can see the receding shoreline. But that actually is evidence against what has been presented in this diagram of a higher sea level. Because if indeed they were using this lower ports, it actually would mean that even the sea level was fluctuating and could have been even lower, or as low as it is today in the time of Jesus.
You mentioned those three towns. Jesus pronounced a curse on Bethsaida and Chorazin. What's the story behind
this passage? Mm-hmm. Yeah, this passage is so important. I mean, this is one of the most important passages. We see it in Luke chapter 10, and you can also see it in Matthew chapter 11. And when Jesus pronounces these curses in Luke chapter 10, 13 through 15, and I'll use Luke's gospel, he says, "Woe to you, Chorazin! Woe to you, Bethsaida! For if the deeds of power done in you had been done in Tyre and Sidon, they would have repented long ago, sitting in sackcloth and ashes. But as the judgment, it will be more tolerable for Tyre and Sidon than for you." And then he mentions the third city. "And you, Capernaum, will you be exalted to heaven? No, you will be brought down to Hades." And then he says elsewhere, "It will be more tolerable in the day of Sodom and Gomorrah for you." And so Jesus is mentioning Sodom and Gomorrah, Tyre and Sidon, in direct juxtaposition with Chorazin, Bethsaida, and Capernaum. Now, what do we make of this? And why is he pronouncing these curses on these three cities? Well, I gave you some insight already into why. He spent 85% of his time in this evangelical triangle. So for Jesus to spend 85% of his life, miracles, and ministry in this space, teaching and preaching to a predominantly Jewish audience, and they still rejected him. He was rejected in Capernaum. He was rejected in Chorazin. He was rejected in Bethsaida. And in these cities, we have archaeological evidences of synagogues there. So the religious Jews are attending synagogues in these cities. Jesus is going to their synagogues. He's called disciples from Bethsaida, as we mentioned, Philip and Andrew and Peter. And this Bethsaida is also the site of the feeding of the 5,000, most likely. And you get this hint about Jesus kind of jabbing at Philip from Bethsaida. He actually asked Philip, "Philip, where are we going to get enough food to feed this multitude?" And he asked Philip because he knows Philip is from Bethsaida. Mm-hmm. So this is almost a test. Philip knows there's no place to buy this food for these many people. But Jesus is doing these great miracles, and they do not receive him.
That had never occurred to me, that he asked Philip specifically, because
that's
Philip
right.
was from there and knew the lay of the land. Although Jesus never expected them to go buy food. He knew what was going to happen, and not enough to turn the minds and hearts of the people that were there. Is it possible that Jesus was, in pronouncing those curses, he was expressing plain old human frustration?
Yes, he was, but he was also, this is a bit of a Remez, a geographical Remez, because he is invoking Israel's history. Tyre and Sidon are seaside ports on the Mediterranean. They are on the western, they're west, on, west of Capernaum and west of Bethsaida.
Yeah, I wish we could show maps on the radio. And then both were conquered by Alexander the Great.
Right. So they are ports, but they date back 2000 BC.
Mm-hmm.
And Tyre and Sidon are mentioned in the Annals of the Kings. So you've got King Solomon, who is taking pagan wives. One of them is a Sidonian woman. You've got Solomon bringing cedars from Lebanon. And Hiram, King Hiram, who is building the temple of the Lord with Solomon, is floating cedars from Lebanon from the port of Tyre down to Joppa, where, you know, of the Jonah fame, where Jonah flees to Joppa. He's trying to go to Tarshish instead of where God tells him to go. But Tyre is the port city where Hiram is from. And if you know anything about port cities, I mean, I guess I would liken it to the Virginia Beach area. If you go down there, those military installations and goods coming in and out, or Baltimore, these different port cities, it, you know, they could be a little edgy. Things can pop up around there, like massage parlors and check cashing services.
Well, I'm thinking of Corinth, where Paul stayed for some of that. That was Sin City.
Exactly. So when you're talking about these places where people have anonymity and they're coming and going, they can be very, very debaucherous.
Mm-hmm.
And also, Tyre and Sidon are in the tribal land of Asher. So when the tribal land is broken up, the sons of Jacob, you've got 12 tribal lands, and one of them is the northwestern town or tribal divide of Asher. And kings have traditionally gotten their wives from this tribal land. And King Solomon, again, taking a Sidonian woman who has pagan gods, is from there. Also, the widow of Zarephath that Elijah encounters and raises up her son.
On the coast there as well, Mediterranean coast, yeah.
That's right. That's right here in the land of Tyre and Sidon. So Jesus juxtaposes Capernaum, Bethsaida, and Chorazin with these two towns and one more, Sodom and Gomorrah.
Hmm.
He says in verse 12 of Luke 10, I tell you, it would be more bearable on the day of Sodom than for that town. So Jesus is saying, had I done the works in you, Capernaum, then in Sodom they would have repented, which, by the way, triggers a whole nother thought process of when and how and where would have Jesus done any of these miracles in Sodom? When was Jesus in Sodom? That has been destroyed in the days of Abraham in Genesis. Well, we can get into that because Jesus has said in John 8, before Abraham was, I am. This is one of the eight, I think, an eighth I am statement.
I've heard it taught that just about any time there's an encounter with an angel or an encounter with God directly, an earthly being, it was in fact Jesus.
They call it the angel of the Lord. And there's a capital L here, and we see this with Samson's parents when they encounter the angel of the Lord. They said they're amazed that after encountering the angel of the Lord, they're still alive. And they, quote, say, we have seen God.
Hmm.
And we have lived to tell the tale. And so here in John chapter 8, we've got this reference. And Jesus himself says, Abraham rejoiced to see my day and was glad in it.
Hmm.
Well, they pick up stones to stone him. Are you greater than our father Abraham? You're not even 50 years old, and you're saying you've seen Abraham. And when we encounter, when we go back and look at Genesis 18 at this passage, we see that Abraham is speaking with the angel of the Lord, and it's a capital L, Lord. And this could be, many people like think that this is a pre-incarnate Christ, a theophany, some say. And David Murray actually does a really good, I think it's David Murray. He writes a book called Jesus on Every Page, and he tracks the angel of the Lord throughout the Old Testament narrative, but Jesus is claiming it. I mean, if you're not comfortable with the Old Testament narrative, just listen to Jesus' own words in John 8. And these woes to both Tyre, Sidon, and Sodom and Gomorrah, or excuse me, Capernaum. And you see these woes he's speaking out of Chorazin, Bethsaida, and Capernaum. And he's juxtaposing, saying Sodom and Gomorrah and Tyre and Sidon are better off.
There's that half of the saying that I need to, that comes to mind now, that the New Testament is the Old Testament revealed.
Mm-hmm. And the Old Testament is in the New Testament revealed. The New Testament is in the Old Testament concealed. And yes, that's how we have to look at it. Mm-hmm. They are calling. It's like a call and response to one another. We can't fully have one without the other. And this is why I get so frustrated with some mainline evangelicals. I know Andy Stanley got in trouble a while back because of his trying to jettison. We don't need the Old Testament anymore. We've got this new revelation of Jesus. Well, that just doesn't jive.
Now, that would be a profound mistake. It stuns me, and it's coming to me all over again now, fresh again, how integral geography and history are to proving the veracity of the Bible. It is a unified whole when you add those elements. And people who don't study that, don't have a sense for the power of those things, for the geographic and historic context, how easy it is to miss the truth that's there.
Right. Which is why I love that Philip Yancey wrote a book a while back called The Bible Jesus Read, which should provoke thought, like, what? Jesus read a Bible? Of course he did. He was Jewish. He read the Torah, the law and the prophets, the history of his people. But we somehow edit Jesus out of his context. We take him, we take Jesus himself out of his Jewish context, and we cannot understand the teachings of Jesus without entering into that world. And this is a perfect example, the evangelical triangle. Here it is. Jesus pouring 85% of his life, miracles, and ministry into Chorazin, Bethsaida, and Capernaum. They don't get it. He says, well, let me cite three major cities that you're going to know of, and you will think that they are the last and the least of the people who would ever get it right. And I'm telling you, had I done half of these things in these cities, they would have repented long ago. He literally says Sodom and Gomorrah would still be standing had I done these things in that city. And of course, we know that he doesn't. We know that the angel of the Lord destroy. There's two angels that destroy Sodom and Gomorrah because there's not one righteous person in it. And there's this whole auction debate between Abraham. What if you find 50? What if I find 50 righteous people in Sodom? Will you spare the city then? Sure. Oh, okay. How about 40? How about 30? And they get to 10. Like, look, if you find anyone righteous in that place, I'll spare it. And God's just saying, giving more ground. But indeed, there's no one righteous, no, not one. The place is destroyed. It's one of the most debaucherous places, and we even reference it that when we're talking about evil places, we'll say that place is like Sodom. And Jesus is saying, man, had I done one of these miracles, had I done these things, said these things, done these things in that place, it would still be standing. You people don't get it. Woe to you, Chorazin. Woe to you, Bethsaida. And you, Capernaum, are you any better? No way.
And another eye-opener, Jesus pronounces his curse on Bethsaida, and it disappears for 17 centuries.
Yeah, so back to that archaeological find. It is astounding, the layers in that tell. And again, to your listeners, a wonderful resource, along with preserving BibleTimes.org with context. For biblical archaeology, is biblicalarchaeology.org, where we're referencing this. There's actually a free book, The Galilee Jesus Knew. If you sign up for Biblical Archaeology's reviews emails, you can get a copy, free PDF copy of The Galilee Jesus Knew. And you can also look at some of the more edited versions of the article we're mentioning today, or become a member. And there is an article published January, February 2000, Bethsaida Rediscovered. And here we're getting a lot of information about the multiple layers of this Jewish town.
Incidentally, if archaeology is of interest, you might head to Preserving Bible Times, too. Again, that's preservingbibletimes.org. You can click on the Two Crowns video. It doesn't cost you a penny. It's a 30-minute video, and you get intimate looks at Caesarea, at Masada, at the Herodium, and at Jerusalem as it existed in the first century. It's a video. In fact, you can see it two ways now. There's a 30-minute video, or it's also available segmented into shorter sections if you don't want to sit there for half an hour and you want to come back and, say, look specifically at Masada or specifically at the Herodium. It's an amazing photography there. It'll light up your day. It's called Two Crowns, King Herod versus King Jesus, and it's at preservingbibletimes.org. Been talking with Pastor Robbie Pruitt, and it was a productive I learned a lot of stuff, and in fact, I've got more questions for you now and no time to address them. Maybe we can pick them up in a week or so. Like this, if Jesus was so familiar with that territory, is it possible that he knew Philip and Andrew and Peter before he called them to be disciples? I kind of suspect that it's a bunch of small towns. I think they probably at least had heard of him. Anyway, well, we can wrestle with that another time. Robbie Pruitt, thank you so much. Appreciate your time today and your expertise and your heart. We'll see you next week.
Looking forward to next week, Jim. Thanks for having me on.
Bye-bye.